Hi there, and welcome to The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping you find your true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind. The voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me as we have a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Conscious Communicator. This is Rusty. Welcome back. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you had a wonderful time. Today we're talking about inner strength, and my guest is Asha Praver, who is joining us from the Bay Area. Asha, thank you very much for coming on today.
I'm very happy to be here.
So you're down in the Bay Area. I understand you and your husband moved there a while ago to create a community that you now live in, and can you explain that to us a little bit?
Sure. I'm part of a group of communities, a network of communities called Ananda, and we're based on the teachings of Paramhansa Yogananda. Many people have read Autobiography of a Yogi. It's one of those books that you find early in your search, and I was fortunate in 1969 to meet a direct disciple of Yogananda's. Yogananda was from India. He came to America in 1920, but he died in 1952. But in 1948, all these dates, a man named Swami Kriyananda, who is an American, he was 22 years old at the time, and he read Autobiography of a Yogi. But Yogananda was still living in Los Angeles, so Kriyananda, he's called Donald Walters then, he just left everything in New York City and went to Los Angeles and became a direct disciple of Yogananda. And now, 60 years later, Kriyananda is still living. And Yogananda had this idea that what we really needed in this country at this time was people who were committed to spiritual life, wanting to meditate, wanting to change their way of living, to group together. Because it isn't exactly the mainstream way of life. It's more so now, but still, most people are thinking in other ways. And he knew it would be better for people if they could live together with like-minded people. So
right.
Kriyananda had that idea, and when I met him in 1969, he was starting this community up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. It was really nothing much more than just bare land, but I just threw my lot in with his and helped build that community. And then a number of years later, my husband and I came to the city here and started another one. So
you talked about people. I'm sorry. You talked about people on their search, and they found some of these autobiographies early on in their search. Can you describe what your search was? And again, our show talks a little bit about the idea of becoming more conscious and becoming more aware of maybe some of those internal challenges that we're facing, or some of that emptiness that. You know, the meditation and some of the things that people do to try and answer some of those questions. Can you speak about your early journey into this?
Oh, sure. I think like many people, from my earliest childhood, I was always asking questions. I was raised in a very nice way. My family was Jewish. We weren't very religious, but, they were intelligent people and very good to me. So it wasn't like I was unhappy or anything, but I remember just looking out the window the little suburban house we lived in, and just thinking, I was sort of like just stare with great intensity and wait for the curtain to part so I could see something that I could almost see that was just behind the view out my window. I just had this feeling there was some much more important and greater, more wonderful drama going on than just the ordinary life I was looking at. But the fact is, I also, when I was a child, like the way children think, I thought all these grown-ups around me must know. They must have a deeper understanding of the meaning of life. They're just waiting till I'm older, and then they'll tell me. But as I grew up, I discovered that they were just taking life as it was. They didn't seem to be driven like I was to find something more substantive than just, growing up, taking care of yourself, taking care of somebody else. It just wasn't enough. So I stumbled when I was about 18, and this was in the 60s when, things were beginning to crack open in lots of directions. A good friend of mine handed me some books. They were actually by Vivekananda. They were basically Eastern religion. And it was sort of like everything went ka-ching in my mind. It was like, I felt like for the first time I was reading something that was speaking to what I really wanted to know, which was, what are the universal laws of human life? Why were we born? And above all, what I really wanted was, how can we be happy? I could just sense this sort of potential for misery just lurking on the edges of everything. And I had this extraordinarily deep longing for happiness, and nobody was ever talking to me about how to be happy. They were just talking to me about making money and, you know, being famous or cultivating this or that, but nobody's talking about being happy. It seemed like without happiness, what are we going to do? And then I started studying Eastern religion, and they started talking about eternal bliss. Now, you know, that's the question I've been asking. So basically, I was on that path just as a reader, you know, reading books, going to the bookstore, and just coming home with volume after volume. And somewhere in there, a friend of mine called me up on the phone. She said, I've met a real teacher. Those were the words she used. And I live in Palo Alto, and I did then, too. And Stanford University is here. And someone had invited Swami Kriyananda to speak at Stanford. So November 1969, I was 22. I was in this, actually it was an outdoor pavilion, and he walked in, and, you know, I wouldn't have thought of myself as being so intuitive, but that man walked into the room, and I could feel his consciousness. I knew just barely enough to know what that might mean, but I could feel that his consciousness was different than anyone I had ever seen, and that it was exactly what I was looking for. And pretty much in about 30 seconds, I decided this man was my teacher and this was what I was looking for. And now it's been almost 40 years and I've never wavered from that.
When you think about, when you talk about the idea that, you know, that there's a veil,
yeah,
you know, the idea that we're missing something, what is it that the average person is missing? What is it that the average person is not seeing? Can you qualify that at all? Because I tend to come from a bit more of a rationalist school of thought, thinking that for whatever reason this world is what it is. It's part of the process of learning and evolving and growing and so forth. And I tend to not want to try and write this off as being something that we're blind to, as opposed to the idea that there's so much more. What's the average person missing?
Oh, you know, Rusty, I'm so glad you put it like that. That's very well put, because there's this huge misunderstanding that somehow that reality is all chopped up, and you accept one and you reject the other. You become spiritual and you leave the world behind. You become spiritual, become irrational. You know, all of that. It's not. I don't think it's any of that at all. This creation is made of one substance. It's consciousness, it's thought, it's energy coalesced into matter, but there's no edges to it. It's all one unified expression on more and more subtle levels. But every reality has its own, it's necessary to relate to every level of reality appropriately. So here we are, we're human beings, we live, we have bodies, we have bodily imperatives. You know, love, comfort, sex, food, rest, warmth. And as long as we're in a body, those bodily imperatives have to be dealt with. And they have to be dealt with on whatever level is appropriate for us. But there's also, even within the physical body, there's all these other subtle levels of thought and feeling and the possibility of a very refined experience of beauty, of pleasure, of love. And even within these physical bodies, we can have very, very subtle experiences of transcendence, of eternity, of unconditional happiness. And so I think people kind of, it's like a radio station that's broadcasting all the time. Many different shows are broadcasting, and we tune in to whatever dimension of reality we are receptive to. You know, we are receiving stations. And so for me, when I was a little kid, I had this, and I still have, I'm exactly the same. I have this deep longing for pure happiness. I mean, and I don't just mean like, oh, I feel good today because everything went my way and tomorrow I feel terrible. And the pure happiness to me was this thought that there must be a way to live that is fundamentally in harmony with, I didn't know words like eternal bliss at that time, but just there must be a way to fundamentally live where happiness is always with you. Because I could see how life goes up and down so much. So I think to come back to your exact question, I think the veil is that people imagine, people as a whole, I think, imagine that whatever is happening now will go on in the same way. And we have the illusion that we can control more than we can actually control. We have a misunderstanding about time. We don't realize that time will pass, even though time always passes. And I think we sometimes fail to perceive the universal laws of human happiness behind the everyday experiences. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, but let's flesh it out some more. What are some of those laws? What are some? And again, what I always like to do is try to give our listeners some concrete tools that they can work with. Because, you know, as being somebody that's in the psychology field in counseling, very interesting is it tends to be psychology in some of the higher levels. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for example, self-actualization and some of the things that you're talking about are at the very top of that pyramid.
Right.
And I think most of us, and even, you know, a lot of people, you know, who are highly educated, deal in the lower two or three spectrums simply out of necessity more than anything else. Not that they have the opportunity to really sit and contemplate some of the ideas that you're talking about, and maybe that's just laziness on our part. But it seems to me a luxury. That a lot of people, for whatever reason, just don't think that they can afford. Are there some ideas of what these universal laws are? Where are we in terms of understanding, you know, how we fit into this, and some ways that people at a very base level can start to grasp what you're talking about? Because obviously, for you, it's a 40-year journey into this experience. For us,
right.
It's a, you know, a 40-minute ride.
Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, I don't think we're really that far apart. As a counselor and a psychologist, your intention with people is to help them understand themselves, understand what motivates them, understand where they're trying to go, understand how to get there. And what all of us find usually is that our greatest obstacle to getting where we're trying to go is ourselves, you know, the conflicts that we have within us, and the difference between our intention and what we can actually put forward. Let me start to think exactly how to say this. I think certain laws of human happiness are mostly defined in the great religious traditions of the world by the more we identify. Okay, here's the way to say it. You know, the more limited our self-identification, the more limited our capacity for fulfillment and happiness. The broader our sense of self-identification, the broader our potential for happiness. And it's directional. It's not an all-or-nothing thing. Like an individual, let's just think in very concrete terms, an individual who only thinks of himself and his own pleasure, or herself and her own pleasure, even to form a meaningful primary relationship, a marriage-type relationship, is very difficult if that person can't identify their own well-being with the well-being of the person they purport to love. So if you can expand your sense of identity and your sense of well-being to include the well-being of even one other person, it begins to allow you to form experiences that you can't have if you only identify with yourself. You can add to that responsibility, let's say, for a meaningful job, or for the raising of children, or for the welfare of your community. And the broader our sense of identification becomes, the more possibilities of experience we have, and the more refined our experience can become. on the hierarchy that you describe, the question fundamentally is there any limit to how far we can expand our sense of self-identity according to the traditional traditions of all the great religions? Literally, our self-identity can become infinite. And, of course, inherent with that is the idea that that infinite awareness is an ever more blissful awareness. I think some people feel that greater awareness also brings with it greater suffering, and they fear it. And so we think that we're happier if we're less aware. These are stages we have to go through. I would say living with higher awareness, with greater awareness, is one of the laws of human happiness that I would recommend.
Awareness being their connection to all of the things, is that what you're
well,
talking about?
Awareness. Go on, what you were saying.
Well, I mean, you know, again, I was sitting there thinking as you were talking about a family, for example, and a husband includes his wife and then includes his children and then, you know, includes to a certain extent their friends and some of the external family, but at some point they start to build walls so that they can protect what they have. And the idea of being aware of the needs of people who have suffered, people who, you know, for example, in my field, I do a lot of education for people coming out of prison, and we work with child offenders or child abusers, and the idea that somebody like that they could connect with that person, or that they could connect, you know, even outside of their own cul-de-sac, or outside of their own football team, or the outside of their own nation. I mean, we've been, you know, inundated with the idea of that, you know, of patriotism to a particular nation. And you know, a lot of what we see in the Middle East and some of the problems that we're seeing back there are tribal notions of what, how far we can expand our reality. So, you know, again, I understand the idea of expanding one's reality, the difficulty that you face in trying to help somebody to do that. How do you help them to overcome that sense that there are limits?
You know, it's very interesting to talk to you, Rusty, and I really appreciate this. You know, just because your perspective is thoughtful and a little different than mine. Here's the key as I hear you speak. See, you're thinking of it, and you almost might say you have an external expansion. You know, the first there's my wife, then there's my kids, then there's my kids' friends, then there's my neighbors, and there's the people across the street. You know, just it feels very difficult. It feels exhausting, even as you tell me. The reality of it is that the expansion is first internally through a deeper and deeper sense even of what a human being is. This is where the concept of meditation and spirituality comes into this in the way that I understand it. If you're looking at, let's say, the fingers of your hand, and you're just looking at all those fingers as separate, and even if your hand is stretched in front of you and the fingers are spread out, and you imagine yourself at the tips of those fingers, there's all this distance. And the effort to span that distance is what, you know, what you're talking about. And then you manage to expand, cover all those gaps to include all five of those fingers, and then you have the five fingers of the next hand, and there's all these gaps you have to cover. If instead, and in this sense you would have to, you trace back from the tips of the fingers down to the palm, and then you're standing at the palm, and from the position of the palm you can see how even right where you stand, yourself extends out into all those fingers. That the identity, your self-identity, becomes expanded more in a foundational way, or really what I really want to say is in a divine way. One begins to understand oneself, that the tip of the finger is a manifestation of the power that comes from the palm. And then you stand in the power that comes from the palm, and you can easily reach out to all the branches, and it doesn't feel exhausting. It feels rather that every individual that you meet is a reflection of that same source energy, and therefore is already familiar to you. It's not a stretch over a gap of separation. It's rather seeing that same reality in a new form. All the branches of one tree. I mean, religion has put it poetically, we're all children of the same one Father, they would say. And we embrace one another as kinsmen automatically. There's a spontaneous sense of kinship. And that's the kind of expansion that I'm speaking of. That doesn't mean, practically speaking, that you run around feeding everybody on earth, because you also have to relate to every situation on its own level appropriately. If I'm the father of a family and I have my family to take care of, that may, in practical terms, be as far as my actual responsibility can spread. But my sense of kinship and sympathy, because of my inner awareness, can easily spread literally limitlessly, but then my responsibilities may still have a smaller circle around them. Is that a fair explanation?
Yeah, and, again, I appreciate you working with me on these. Like I said, I always try as much as I can to try and get down to some concrete brass tacks levels so that the listeners can try and incorporate some of this stuff into
sure.
what they're doing. In terms of, you mentioned earlier in your conversation about what a human being really is, I'm assuming that reincarnation is a part of the belief system that you're involved in. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard to make the system work unless you have more than one lifetime to make it work.
Right. My question has always been, why? Why did we start this cycle of reincarnation and learning? If we existed in this place where the palm power that you spoke about is, we had access to it, why'd we leave? Why did we come, why did we join the circle again and again and again in terms of trying to expand the consciousness?
Well, the tradition that I follow is really from India. The explanation given is that the explanations are unsatisfactory, but I can offer them to you. The divine wanted to enjoy itself through many. People answer, well, he's not enjoying himself through very many. But anyway, he wanted to enjoy himself through many. A beautiful explanation that Swami Kriyananda gave recently is, he said, it's the nature of bliss to want to share itself. The infinite spirit is eternal bliss, and it's the nature of it to expand. And whenever one finds something that you enjoy, at least I'm that way, if I find something I enjoy, I want to give it out to everyone. And so they say that the eternal spirit, which is eternal state of bliss, wanted to manifest in all these different forms so that that joy would find expression in all those forms. Another explanation that Vivekananda gave was, the mind that asks the question, the level of consciousness that asks the question, which is why is there creation, is not capable of absorbing the answer. I think that's a cop-out, but it's also a way to say it. I look at it, and Swami Kriyananda, who's been my teacher all these years, has looked at it from another angle, which is whether we understand why we were created, we still have this experience, and the experience we have is one of, I would call it, an intuitive longing in the heart for perfect love and for perfect happiness, and a constant experience of life in which that perfection of love and happiness and fulfillment is generally disappointed, sometimes tragically disappointed, but even if there is no tragedy, even if everything goes in a relatively speaking harmonious and successful way, some people, and I would certainly count myself among them, there's always this feeling, but there has to be more than this. This sort of, in fact, it's sometimes the people who are most successful and most receive most of what they desire, there's still this feeling, but isn't there anything more? Because the heart has this, well, you would call it a memory of perfect bliss. And the reincarnation factor comes in simply, which is we keep searching for that. And after a time, we begin a serious enough quest that we begin to ask deep enough questions that different answers begin to come to us. And until gradually, I mean, even you, with your education and your refinement in the work that you do, you obviously understand more than some of the population that you're helping. So you can see that there's been this, if you want to call it an evolutionary cycle of consciousness, where you're turning back now and you're talking about these prison people come out, these people come out of prison, and you're able to give them something that they don't already have. And you have it because you've suffered, probably, or desired happiness. You can take it from either end. And have asked questions and put forth effort that the people you're helping have not yet done. And you're helping them now to expand their awareness to where you're standing.
I would offer, though, that in my experience of finding happiness for myself, it was more about the acceptance of my situation in terms of you mentioned in your website about external stimulation. I think part of my path was looking for something more. I was constantly looking for something and trying to figure out why and asking questions and chasing after my tail in terms of following spiritual traditions or reading different things or trying to do whatever. And I think for me, I think the acceptance of the here and now without explanation and without a lot of internal dialogue or questioning about it is where I've started to find at least my stride in terms of finding something that I want to do and being able to be out there involving myself in the situation with other people, whether it's through my work in the elementary schools or my work in teaching or my work on the radio. And it, you know, I think part of it for me was that ending of the search process because, you know, I have heard that every meditation eventually becomes a crutch. And it, for me, the chasing after that, the perfect bliss, the immortal, you know, that sort of thing just seemed to me to be, that was leading to the pain more than anything else. And I don't know why that was my experience, but.
Oh, you know, I have a friend.
This is not the lifetime for me to understand it at that level. It's a lifetime for me to try and roll up my sleeves and work with what's right in front of me, and not to ask any questions.
You know, I have a friend who more or less has come to your conclusion. I need to ground this. I mean, I'm just talking way out in the stars. Let me put this on, you know, on solid. Let me put my 2 feet back on the ground and talk about reality like you're talking about it. We're really on exactly the same page. So many people's understanding of spirituality is just way, you know, out there. And it does become ungrounding and unfulfilling and chasing your tail, if that's the word you want to use. See, one of the things that happened to me when I was 22 is I met Swami Kriyananda. I described him in terms of his extraordinary consciousness. But what his real character is and was, he's still alive, solid, absolutely practical, absolutely on the ground, absolutely don't kid yourself, honey, just live as you really are kind of energy. Nothing about, it's like he starts with his feet solidly on the ground and then extends, you know, farther out into the infinite than anyone I know, but there's no gap. You know, if it's raising children that you need to do, if it's earning money that you need to do, if it's a very sort of grounded, hands-on kind of work that you need to do, all of that, it's like wherever a person is standing in truth, you know, what your consciousness really is, who you really are, what's really fulfilling to you, then you need to do that. But everything can be done directionally. You can do everything in such a way that it's a learning experience for you and it's a gradual expansion of your consciousness. And I know, you know, especially in all the years that I've been in this, I've seen people go at spiritual things in lots of different ways. And a lot of people imagine that spiritual life is somehow completely cut off from themselves and everything else that they're doing. And often, as you describe, you sort of almost have to repudiate it to get your feet back on the ground. But then it just becomes a matter of vocabulary, because it sounds to me like what you're doing is deepening your own awareness, deepening your own understanding, and serving others. And I can't think of any other definition of spiritual life than that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, like I said, taking a different path or taking a different way, I think the ability at some level may be limited to lifetimes, you know, and maybe if I was fortunate enough to run into a guru, and you mentioned your teachers and gurus and the lineage and so forth,
uh-huh.
Most of mine, I think, have been non-religious in form. Most of them, ironically, have been women, especially my mother.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm not sure that I ran into that level of understanding, you know, because I think I run into that a lot in family counseling, where you have a goal that's external to what it is that is very obvious and apparent in their situation, which is, you know, you guys got three kids, you've got, you know, some real serious issues going on in the family, and what we need to focus on right here is communication, and really kind of getting through this period of time before we start talking about things like volunteering in the community or getting out there and doing other things. I think oftentimes people confuse spirituality with some form of practice or some form of external validation for, you know, what they're doing, so that they can say, hey, look, I'm spiritual. This is how I prove it, as opposed to dealing with the situation that's right there in front of them and the very pressing needs. I remember when I graduated with my master's, I thought I was actually accepted to join the Peace Corps, and I had a placement. I want to say it was somewhere in Eastern Europe, but I don't remember where it was. I couldn't go for the main reason was my dog, to be totally honest with you. I had absolutely no desire whatsoever to leave my dog, and when I realized I couldn't take him, that was part of it. At the same time, I realized that where I lived in Northern California, in a small town of less than 100,000 people, there were tons of kids who could really, really use my help. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that I was doing was joining the Peace Corps because it sounded cool. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. You basically mistake the form of things for the consciousness of them. I mean,
right.
I mean, where it leads to formal spiritual practice is simply when a person finds, how formal that is, that every day gets better if I also add into it some conscious effort to calm myself, to get in touch with my own inner power, to clarify my mind, to strengthen my heart, to work with my body, whatever it is. You know, there are deliberate practices which basically make everything one has to do go better.
Right.
Develop your intuition, your creativity. You know, the kind of meditation that I practice just basically removes the obstacles to the free flow of my energy and harmonizes the flow of my energy. So in the life that I live and very involved with lots of people and lots of challenges, it all goes better if my heart is clear and if my mind is clear and if my energy flows harmoniously. And so I find that just like I go swimming a number of times a week to keep my body toned, if I keep my mind and spirit toned by the practice of meditation, then everything that relates to mind and spirit also goes better. And I'm a devotee. I believe in God. I have a wonderful inner devotional life, but it's proven in the cold light of day. It's not all the pretty stories I can tell. It's how consistently kind, how consistently selfless, how intuitively conscious of other people's needs. I mean, that's what it's really about in the end. Inner consciousness is proven by outer consciousness.
Do you see an evolution in consciousness? I know a lot of people that come on the show are talking about 2012, and they talk about the idea of a transcendence and sort of an awakening that's going on. Is that your experience as well? Do you see that the rest of us are starting to kind of get up on a different level?
Well, I wouldn't say the rest of us. I would say us, but all of us. But there's a tradition in India. And Yogananda expresses this in Autobiography of a Yogi, of what they call yugas, which means great ages. And many traditions speak of essentially four ages that are cyclical, that you have higher and lower ages on this particular planet Earth, which is what we're living on and talking about. And the tradition in India is that we are transitioning from what was essentially called the age of matter into the age of energy. And the transition really started, you know, strongly in 1900. And what you see since 1900 is this transformation of the entire planet based on a deeper appreciation of the sources of energy. Prior to that time, basically, energy was physical. You had a horse, You had a bullock, you had a human body, and that's how you move things around.
Right.
And then they have the steam engine, and now you have computers, and it's interesting that even motor power is described in terms of horsepower, because that's how the only way people could think of it. You know, this engine is the equivalent to 10 horses.
Right.
But yes, so the end of that is we are definitely in an ascending age, and you see it in the technological advances. You see it in the psychological, metaphysical. People are seeing the whole world scientific, whereas before, people thought matter was a solid reality and a form was fixed forever. And now people understand that matter itself is just vibrations of energy. That's a very subtle thought. And it's leading to all sorts of other things as our understanding of what a human being is just keeps getting more and more refined. Now, simultaneously, what's happening is you essentially have two very strong forces on the planet right now. One is the expansive forward-looking group, and the other is those who are looking backwards and clinging to that, more than clinging to it, fighting desperately to maintain it. And that's the clashes that we see in the many of the saints and sages and prophets basically say that there will be a wonderful transition, but it's not going to be smooth. These two elements are going to smash against each other. And the good news is that we are in an ascending age, and ultimately the more expansive peace-loving will be victorious. But already we can see it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, it tends to be my experience as human beings that we don't usually learn anything significant unless we've really caused a big problem. And then we're like, oh, yeah, that's probably pretty serious. We probably should have paid attention to that.
Yogananda says we don't understand anything until we experience it. And this is where reincarnation comes in. That
right.
We have to go through all these experiences. Yeah.
Well, you talked about your teacher, and I saw here a couple of the questions on there talking about people who have been burned in the past and how they can find, and really recognize a true teacher. When you talk about being a teacher in the tradition that you're speaking about, what is that relationship like?
Well, one of the reasons people get burned is, first of all, in the West, we don't have a very clear understanding of what gurus and what true teachers are. And we're a little bit credulous, and people have taken advantage of our credulity. And there's another, we also don't have a very clear understanding of what it means to be a disciple. We don't understand the extent to which nobody can do anything for you. That all we're ultimately totally responsible for ourselves, that anybody who promises you essentially to remove from you the necessity to fight your own battles and win them is not really going to be able to help you very much. Just like a mother who takes away from the child the opportunity to learn does not raise a strong child. The concept of a teacher is exactly like a loving mother, but with sufficient wisdom. I think that one of the things the first thing you have to do if you're looking for a teacher is that you have to become a disciple. And I don't mean by that you become an obedient servant to whoever wants to boss you around. I mean one becomes, one first needs to develop true humility. And Paramahansa Yogananda, it defined humility in a perfect sense. He said, humility is self-honesty. Humility is simply understanding who you really are and what your own limits are. And it goes both ways, because if you're humble, you can also recognize that you're very good at certain things. You have talent in certain ways or ability in a certain way. And humility comes from just seeing that in proportion, even if you're the best violinist on planet Earth. You know, sooner or later you'll die and be forgotten. But if you are the best violinist, you simply are. But there it is. It's just what it is. So first you have to have the humility to actually be able to be taught, to be comfortable in what you do know and relax in what you don't know so that you're receptive and interested. You have to be open-minded and to imagine that The limit of your present knowledge is not the limit of knowledge. Because without those qualities, the wisest person in the world could come right in front of you and you wouldn't recognize them because you'd be too involved in your own thinking. Then the second thing is you have to be very calm and realize that the relationship with a true spiritual teacher especially is a very deep and long-lasting experience, and you don't have to rush it. You don't have to hurry. You don't have to be anxious. You don't have to be afraid you're going to miss it. You need to let it unfold in a very natural way and be very respectful but relaxed. You have to feel comfortable in the company of someone that you want to learn from, because if the person makes you anxious or nervous, you'll never be able to learn. No one can learn when they're afraid. I think you have to observe carefully the words and the actions of the one you're interested in. But I think above all, sometimes it's very hard to tell the character of a teacher, because often he or she is acting from a context you might not be so familiar with. But one of the ways you can tell is that you look at the people who themselves have followed the teacher and the teaching for a long time, and you see the fruit in them of what that practice will give you. And you can judge a lot about whether a path belongs to you by how you feel about the other people who follow it. And if their personalities, their way of life, if it's attractive to you, and you can see yourself emulating it, even if not in detail, but at least in the vibration of it, that's also a good sign. Now, I know that nowadays a lot of people have thrown themselves into things, and then in the end they've been very disappointed. And I think that's it's a very tricky business. I think one has to pull back and try to reflect as honestly as possible what was good and what was bad. But it's a little bit like falling in love and being disappointed, or getting married and then end up divorced. You have to ask yourself whether true love is possible, whether true wisdom is possible, whether true teaching is possible. And merely because one experience didn't come out to be the way you hoped, just like in failed relationships, you need to stand back and try to see what went right and what went wrong, and then learn from that for the next experience. I think that in spiritual seeking, you have to be just the same way.
How many of you, the Ananda communities, you'd mentioned that there was more than one of them. Are these places where you're finding people that are coming who are kind of on the same contemplative or same kind of knowledge-seeking path, in terms of finding a place where they can be surrounded by other people who are also on the path, and where teachers are available and so forth?
Well, yes. Ananda, we have 8 communities. We have a very large community, a rural community, which is Ananda Village, outside of Grass Valley, California. And that's like, we have 1,000 acres, several hundred people. The community's been there for 4 decades. And it's a whole, essentially it's an alternate society. We have schools. We have a beautiful yoga retreat there called The Expanding Light. If anybody who is listening wants to visit, just go on the web. You can go Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A, .org, or look up Expanding Light. And that's a place you can go and visit. Eventually you can live there if you want to. The purpose of it, quite simply, is, you know, to practice meditation, to be really thinking in an expansive, different way. It's not so common, and it's a little bit harder to do if you're the only one in town. So that was the first community, was that rural community. We have a similar community in Assisi, Italy. And then in other places in the U.S., just a few cities, Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Palo Alto, and Santa Monica. We have like a teaching center and a temple, and we have a residential community. We have a residential community here in the Palo Alto area. Basically what we did is we took a master lease on an apartment complex. And so we all just live in individual apartments, and so you have as much privacy and freedom as you want. But all your neighbors, and you know, you look out your door, and everybody who's living so close to you is a compatible spirit. People who are also meditating also have a spiritual idealism in their life. But most of the people in the urban communities just have regular jobs in the area. They just
we all just come home at night here. I mean, I myself and my husband work for the community and through the teaching center in the temple. And then the temple acts like a church. People come on Sundays. They come during the week for classes, and we teach people. We teach people how to meditate. We teach them about this philosophy. We teach them healing methods. We run yoga classes. We have a school for children. We've been running a school here for about 16 years. And so it's like you have this big family. And a lot of the people live in the you know, community, but many of them just have their own homes and their own lives. But we provide their spiritual community, education, inspiration, support, friendship. For some of them, they send their children to our school. So it just makes life much richer to have a lot of like-minded friends.
When you talk about meditation, it seems like it's kind of the cornerstone of a lot of what the expansion, the directional expansion of consciousness and the awareness piece. And you talk about helping people learn how to meditate. What would be some ideas if somebody who's listening wants to try and start, say they are a little wary of teachers, or they're not interested in jumping in right yet, they want to try it on their own. What's a good way for them to get started?
Well, I do think you really need to understand that even though meditation is a very natural practice, a little instruction goes a long way.
Right.
I know I was in Chicago and a cab driver asked me what I do. My husband and I were together. We say, well, you know, we have a long and short answer. The short answer is we run a meditation center. Oh, he said, I tried to meditate. He said, I went in a dark room, closed my eyes. He said, didn't work. And I said, well, I don't suppose it would. You know, the mind's really restless. You have to learn how to make it work. It's like any other refined skill. You have to work at it. Now, so I would say first, at least get a book. I would recommend Ananda publishes a book called How to Meditate. Couldn't be simpler. How to Meditate by John Novak. Very simple, very good book. You can go on to ananda.org. You can order meditation lessons through the internet. The fundamental practice of meditation, the first technique that most people learn, has to do with watching the breath. You have to understand that don't kid yourself. You're going to keep thinking. Your mind's going to be restless. The mind's been running away with itself for your whole life. It doesn't just stop because you've suddenly decided you want it to stop. And you also have to realize that success in meditation is just beginning to meditate. It's not necessarily having this deep cosmic experience. It's just trying to begin to explore the possibility of inner self-mastery, of being able to actually choose your state of consciousness, choose your thoughts, choose your feelings, and not just have your inner reality be on the self-perpetuating cycle that you can't master. Breath is the link between consciousness, between the external and the internal consciousness. It's sort of between a conscious and an unconscious force. And the fundamental practice first of meditation, generally you sit with the spine straight. Lying down is not a good idea because there's a strong association between sleep and lying down. So you want to sit in an upright position in a comfortable flat chair with the spine straight if you can, in the sense of sitting up straight. And the position of the eyes has a great deal to do with where your consciousness is. When you begin to fall asleep, your eyes drop and look downward. When we're at the conscious level, your eyes are generally looking straight out. And when we meditate, you want to raise your eyes just above the horizon line. People talk about the point between the eyebrows, the spiritual eye, but don't think of it as going back into your forehead. Think rather if you put your thumb out in front of you, just slightly higher than the horizon line, and just looked at it with open eyes, there's a point where the two eyes converge very comfortably at a point of focus in front of you. And if you sort of find that point of focus just above the horizon line and look into that reality, in truth, in time, a great light will appear. If that light doesn't appear, don't worry about it. Just sort of look at that point and essentially use your imagination to imagine like a sunrise coming up over the horizon. So you're sitting straight. Your eyes are just above level in a very relaxed way. Don't strain. Then begin to try to become conscious of the fact that you're breathing. You see, meditation is expanding awareness. We are always breathing, but we are rarely conscious of the fact that we're breathing. It's one of the many things that we just were not aware enough to know. So if you want to just first just become simply conscious of the fact that the breath is flowing in and out. And then you want to begin to follow that breath with your concentration. Just feel the breath flowing in, feel the breath flowing out. There's many exercises you can do where you also try to control the breath, but now we're just going to talk about observing it. When you become conscious of how the breath is actually flowing in and out, then add to that an affirmation, because otherwise the mind will just continue. You'll be able to watch the breath and the mind will continue to do everything it always does. So you need to fill the mind with either a mantra, which is a power sound, or an affirmation, or both. A very positive affirmation for the breath is simply, as the breath flows in, you say, I am, which is just a simple affirmation too of, I am pure existence. And then as the breath flows out, you say, peace. I am peace. And what that's doing is that's giving you a way to replace thoughts with a simple word phrase. And it's also giving you a feeling quality that you can tune into. The spine is straight. The eyes are slightly raised. We're observing the breath. And as the breath itself flows in and out, we tie this affirmation to it. I am peace. You can say, I am one with the infinite spirit. In fact, a very great tradition is to say, Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. That's an ancient mystical tradition, is that you say that little prayer in coordination with the breath. Practice this whenever you think to practice it, or for minutes at a time, for hours at a time, or intermittently through the day. And what you find is it becomes an anchor point, because you are opening the doorway to an inner state of consciousness which is actually there. You may be using affirmation and imagination at the beginning to put you in tune with it, but this is not an imaginary experience. This is a real presence within you that you can attune yourself to and then begin to see. Does that make sense?
Do you have any comments about what that cacophony of consciousness is, that constant, you know, seemingly repetitive? They say we have 50,000 thoughts a day, of which 45,000 of them are the same ones we have every single day. You know, and again, I tend to think that consciousness is evolving. I tend to think that it's happening. I think we're in the very beginning parts of understanding its capabilities. I think it's, you know, it's young in terms of a situation that we're really becoming aware of, and most of us are controlled by it as opposed to trying to control it. But you talk about them gaining mastery over consciousness, and
right.
Do you have any sense of what that cacophony is, or that just the repetitive nature of its existence as it exists right now?
Well, the way the yogis describe it is they talk about the chakras, which are subtle centers within the body that run down the middle of the spine. The chakras, each, in the simplest way to describe it, each represent vibrations of consciousness. In any given day, we respond to situations on some spectrum of consciousness, ranging from, I am a physical body, my happiness depends on my materiality, I am mortal, I am easily threatened, to, I am one with the infinite spirit and I am in an eternal state of bliss. And every time we have a thought or a feeling, it represents a commitment to a certain level of reality. And each of the chakras becomes a storehouse for the energy. When you put out a thought or a feeling or an action, it doesn't go away. You have acted with ego identification and it remains tied to your energy form, which is let's call it the ego for lack of a better word. The energy reality of who you are is the accumulated total of every thought, feeling, and action you've ever had. This is why under hypnosis, people can remember their babyhood. Or even when people have these near-death experiences, they realize that all the experiences of their life are still with them, even if they don't remember them. So they store in the chakras, and then those chakras become magnetic whirling vortices. Chakra means wheel. And I think like your point of concentration, the point of awareness, is like a very light piece of metal, like an iron filing. And those habitual ways of thinking sort of draw the consciousness back. There's this constant magnetic interplay between the power of your present intention and the magnetic pull of the accumulated habit. And so at any moment, depending, you know, if for example, one gets really engrossed in listening to or playing a piece of music or writing a poem or loving a child, there'll be moments where that your concentration and attraction to whatever it is so great that everything else goes away. You know, you'll look up and 2 hours have passed and you've just been working on this essay and nothing else had as much power to take your concentration as that did. And then there'll be other times you'll be walking down the street and suddenly you'll remember some past sadness, and all of a sudden the power of that past sadness will just eat you up, and maybe days before you get your consciousness back. And so it's a constant interplay between the present intention and the habitual drawing down of the past. Meditation is the art, actually, of working with the chakras and gradually harmonizing, releasing, uplifting, redirecting all those habitual energies so that you can choose your point of concentration and not have it be constantly the choice taken away from you by the magnetic pull of those habits.
Yeah, my understanding, at least from the perspective of being an observer, is to take a step back from this being the thinker, as opposed to being the thinker and becoming the observer of the thoughts themselves, as opposed to being involved in that. You know, I wish that my thoughts were like, you know, I could get songs stuck in my head. I'll wake up in the morning and there's a song stuck in my head that I haven't heard in weeks or whatever. So I'm aware of it. I don't know if it's you know, what it means in terms of trying to learn to sit with it and to pay attention to it, but you know, I think part of the goal for me is to try and help people to become more aware of some of the things that are going on inside of them, how their thoughts create their feelings and their realities, and that you know, if you want to change the world around you, it's probably the best place to start is to start with changing how you think about it and how you experience those thoughts and where they're coming from. And if nothing else, just to be quiet for a few minutes and take, you know, take stock in some of the things that are occupying your mind without judgment. You know, and that's another thing too, is I tend to be very judgmental a lot of times in my own head, and I think that's something that a lot of us could use to become better at, is not being so judgmental of ourselves or other people.
You know, Rusty, we're on exactly, we have different vocabularies, we have different like ways of describing the reality, but really the reality ends up the same. There's the thoughts and there's the observer. You try to strengthen the observer. Meditation is a technique for strengthening the observer, for stepping back a little bit from what compels you and understanding it just from a bigger point of view. And in that, the business of judging yourself, exactly. You know, the way I often say to people is, if there's a white sheet and then there's a black dot, pitch black, that's as big as a quarter, if you walk right up and you put your eye right against that black spot, then really that's all you see. If you can expand your awareness so that the black spot is still there and it's still the same size, it's still just as black, but you see it in the context of the whole white sheet, it's not like the black has been eliminated. It's just that it looks very different when you see it in context. And what happens to us in the normal course of human life is that we live too close to ourselves. And so we do judge other people, we judge ourselves, because we've got the dark circle so close to our eyes that we don't really recognize that that isn't what's really happening. And so meditation is just expanding your awareness so that it may all still be there. You may be exactly the same person, everybody around you is the same person, but by expanding the context, you see it very differently. You know, when a little child does something childish, it may not be a very good action in itself, but you see it in the context of this. If this is a child, this child will grow up, this is a learning experience, you know. And so if we can see ourselves really in a very similar context, this is not a good action in itself, but I'm a child, and I'm learning, and I'm on this big learning curve, and then it's much more easy to be generous with ourselves. And
cleaning the window to the soul.
Cleaning the window to the soul, that's a good way to put it. Exactly.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being with us tonight. I really appreciate you spending the entire hour with me. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope that maybe someday you'll join us again, or maybe I'll get an opportunity. I don't live very far from Grass Valley. I'm actually in Chico, so maybe I should shoot up there one time and check it out on my way to Tahoe or something like that. I'd love to stop by the community. But I really appreciate you being with me today and for sharing your ideas and your thoughts and your obvious love and passion for your subject. It means a lot to me to meet people who share a similar passion for whatever it is they're doing, and it's obvious to me that that's something that's very important to you.
Well, I appreciate meeting you too, Rusty, for exactly the same reason. It's been a very nice hour.
Thank you guys, everyone out there, for listening. We appreciate it. Next week's guest, I think, I'm not really sure who it is yet, but we'll find out here. It'll be on the website this week. You can always email me at RadioRusty@Hotmail.com. I appreciate you spending some time with us tonight, and hopefully you picked up some tips that can be beneficial to you in terms of what I like about what Asha said there at the end was strengthening the observer. Have a great evening, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Don.
Hi, my name is Rusty May, and I'm the host of The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping people find their true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only they can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind, the voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me each week for a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice. I'll see you on Sunday.